So the plasma membrane of a muscle cell is called what? Sarcolemma, because sarco means flesh and sarcolemma means the plasma membrane. It gets its own name. Now on the sarcolemma, when an action potential comes down, it travels along the membrane until it reaches a particular channel. What is that channel called? It's the L-type calcium channel. So the action potential comes and it surges across the sarcolemma until it finds the L-type calcium channel. Now the L-type calcium channel has a physical connection to the receptor on the SER, which is the sarcoplasmic reticulum, just another ER, but gets a special name for being inside the muscle, sarcoplasmic reticulum, SER. What is that receptor called? What is the name of the receptor to which the L-type calcium channel of sarcolemma of the plasma membrane binds, and this receptor should be sitting on the sarcoplasmic reticulum? It's the ryanodine receptor. So when the signal comes, it reaches the L-type calcium channel on the sarcolemma. And from the L-type calcium channel on the sarcolemma, there's a physical connection that activates the ryanodine receptor on the SER, sarcoplasmic reticulum. Now, if sarcoplasmic reticulum uses the ryanodine receptor to allow the calcium to leave, then what does the sarcoplasmic reticulum use to collect the calcium back? That uses the abbreviation SERCA. SER obviously stands for sarcoplasmic reticulum, C for calcium, A for ATP, because now it was easy to release calcium from the ryanodine receptor because you had a lot of it, so you didn't need energy to let it go, right? You open the floodgates and it just floods out. But to bring it back in, you need ADP because you're going against the concentration gradient to collect a lot of it. So that is called SERCA, S-E-R-C-A. And what's the protein that holds on to the calcium inside the SER? Calsequestrin, because it sequesters calcium, therefore calsequestrin, and the N indicates a protein. Usually. Now, calsequestrin, does it have high affinity for calcium or low affinity? Low affinity. That might seem a little counterintuitive, but it has low affinity so that it can easily let go of it when it has to be released. You wouldn't want it to keep holding on to it when you want it to release calcium. So calsequestrin actually has low affinity for calcium, but it's able to hold a lot of it. So it has high volume. So it holds on to a lot of calcium. So you want it to hold on to a lot of calcium in its pockets, but you want it to be an easy spender, a loose spender. You don't want it to be thrifty with the calcium. So low affinity, high volume, calsequestrin. What is the typical structure in a muscle cell where you have three components? You have a component in the middle and two components to the left and the right, and they help with muscle contraction, or they help propagate the signal for quick muscle contraction. The structure is called a triad, and this grouping is made up of a central T-tubule, which is the transverse tubule, and to its lateral sides is the sarcoplasmic reticulum, the SER. Now, is the SER and the T-tubule, are they technically part? They're grouped into a triad, but are they technically part of the same structure? No. The T-tubule or the transverse tubule is part of the sarcolemma. It's coming from the plasma membrane or the sarcolemma, whereas the SER is just that. It's the ER. It's the sarcoplasmic reticulum, or the muscle cell's endoplasmic reticulum, if you will. ER, endoplasmic reticulum. Now that we know that they're grouped as a triad, looking at it, from a microscope, I imagine, and even functionally grouped as a triad. Why are they grouped together? What kind of a receptor does the transfer tubule have that is useful for the SER? And actually, because it's useful and because of its structure defines function, it makes sense for them to always be grouped so closely together. So what is the structure on the T-tubule and what is the structure on the SER that interact? So one is a L receptor. I believe it was called, L-type calcium channel. Sorry, not receptor. So one is a L-type calcium channel. That's on the sarcolemma. And that has a physical connection to the ryanodine receptor, which is sitting on the SER. So the two structures are L-type calcium channel on the T-tubule and the ryanodine receptor on the SER. And because they're physically connected, it makes sense for the triad grouping to be observed under a microscope. Which neurotransmitter is released from a neuron onto a muscle cell, onto a voluntarily movable muscle cell? Acetylcholine, also abbreviated as ACH sometimes. When acetylcholine excites or depolarizes a muscle cell, the T-tubule of a muscle cell, what type of receptor or channel is activated? The L-type calcium channel. Which receptor on the SER is excited by the L-type calcium channel from the T-tubule? The ryanodine receptors on the SER are excited to release calcium by the L-type channel on the T-tubule. When we compare voluntary muscle cells for movement to cardiac muscle, so when we compare those two, what is the difference between their respective L-type calcium channels? The difference is that the L-type calcium channel for voluntary muscle movement is simply going to signal the SER to release its calcium. It's not going to move any calcium from the outside of the cell to the inside. Instead, it's going to encourage the SER of the cell to provide the calcium needed for movement. But on the cardiac muscle, the L-type calcium channel will actually use extracellular outside the cell calcium and provide it, move it to the inside of the cell in order for contractions to take place. What do we need for a muscle to continue contracting? Do we need anything special? What cuts it off? What cuts off a contraction? We only need calcium for the myosin to continue to interact with actin and keep contracting the muscle. So as long as the calcium is there to distract troponin and regulate tropomyosin, there's an open site. And as long as there's an open site on the actin, the myosin will continue to row, and the muscle will continue to contract indefinitely. The only way to make this stop is to make the calcium go away. And once calcium goes away, now the myosin is stuck in a state where it can't bind to the actin and the muscle contraction stops. Okay, so let's start the actin-myosin interaction with the state where myosin is ready and waiting, and all it needs is for the binding site on the actin to become available. Okay, so when the myosin is ready and waiting, you know, think of it, you know, it's ready, it's in attention. It's at a 90-degree angle. It's ready, you know, standing straight up on the ground, so you can think of that as perpendicular or 90-degree angle. It's ready to go. And when, you know, calcium binds troponin and tropomyosin moves out of the way, now there's a place to make contact with the actin. Now we can go. But the state where it was waiting, where it was arrested. So the key term is, what state is myosin arrested in? Meaning, or attentive in is what I would like, but arrested in, you know, it's ready to go, but it can't go. So myosin is arrested in a 90 degree angle state. What all is attached to myosin in that state? ADP and a PI or phosphate molecule, or ADP and PI are attached to the myosin in its 90 degree arrested state. Again, I like to think of it as the attentive state, but fine. Now, it's ready to go. Let's say it's able to make contact. So now after making contact, or before making contact, the science like this is not clear, but the point is something has to get released, right? This is at a molecular level. So something's got to move or give for the next step to proceed or happen. So it's the phosphate. So the phosphate molecule is ejected. So now phosphate is no longer there because of its ejection, or as part of its ejection, the myosin and ADP together are finally able to bind the actin. Okay, so there you go. We've made contact. In order to make contact, we gave up on the phosphate molecule. It's gone. But this is weak contact. For it to become like a really, really good grip, right, we also have to get rid of the ADP. So now we eject the ADP, and now we have a really good grip between myosin and actin, and we're ready to row the boat. So now, you know, this is a 45 degree angle. That's what I guess constitutes a really good grip and just the best angle at which to row or to pull or to contract. So now it makes the power stroke. It contracts the fiber. And what happens next is there's room for ADP, right? It's got to get its energy from somewhere to make the next power stroke. So, you know, ADP comes along and says, okay, you know, you need some energy, you're tired, here, I'll attach to you. But it can't just attach to it while it's still bound to actin. So myosin has to be like, okay, I need to get a drink. So it has to leave actin, go get a drink of ADP, and then come back. And this is the opportunity where calcium can come in and block it again. You know, the calcium can release troponin. Troponin can change the conformation of tropomyosin, and tropomyosin can cover up the actin. So, you know, myosin left to get an energy drink, it came back, and now it's not allowed to do any work. Why? Well, sorry, dude, while you left, we blocked the site, we blocked the library room, you can't get in anymore. But, you know, it's ready to go, or almost ready to go, because it's not enough for it to go bind ADP. After binding ADP, it has to hydrolyze it into ADP and PI, the phosphate molecule. So it's not just, you know, attach ATP and come back to work. No, after attaching ATP, you have to digest the ADP. So it digests it into ADP and PI and goes back into its attentive or arrested state at a 90 degree angle, ready to do work. And you know, it has to wait until calcium process happens and troponin and eventually tropomyosin opens the actin binding site by getting out of the way, and it can say, okay, you know, there's a place for me to put my oar and start rowing. Until then, it's stuck in the arrested state again. What is the angle in the arrested state for myosin, and what are the components attached to it? The angle of myosin in the arrested state is 90 degrees, and the components attached to it are ADP and PI. What are the components that the myosin head needs to jettison or eject before it can make contact with the open site of actin? The myosin needs to eject the phosphate molecule, and it will be left with only the myosin head, of course, itself, and the ADP attached to it. What does myosin need to do to get a really good grip, you know, move from a weaker grip to a really good grip with actin before it performs its power stroke? The myosin needs to get rid of its ADP component in order to get into a conformation where it has a really good grip with actin before beginning its power stroke. What angle is the myosin head without ADP and without phosphate at when it goes through the power stroke with actin. During the power stroke, the myosin filament is at a 45-degree angle, and of course, it doesn't have any ADP or PI bound to it at that point. After a myosin head finishes a power stroke with its actin, what needs to happen for the next power stroke to begin? It needs to release the actin, and in order for that to happen, what has to bind to the myosin in order for it to release the actin? It has to bind ATP. Once ATP binds to the myosin head, it's able to release the actin because it has to now go digest its food. What does the myosin head digest ADP into? It digests it into ADP and a phosphate molecule, so ADP and PI, and that puts it in which state ready to go again? It puts it back into the arrested state where, because it had left the actin, calcium could have worked to regulate and close the actin binding site. So it has to stay arrested in 90-degree angle until that binding site becomes available again. So the L-type calcium channels in cardiac cells, not muscle cells, cardiac cells, how do they behave? They allow calcium into the cell. They allow extracellular outside the cell calcium into the cell, which is different from muscle cells that do not allow outside calcium to come in. So now that we know that the cardiac cells have L-type calcium channels that allow the calcium to come in, how exactly is the SER stimulated? Are all the muscle contractions taking place based on outside calcium channel? Or does the SER, which stores calcium, still have a role to play? So the calcium from outside the cell is actually the trigger for the SER to release the calcium from inside, you know, the ER organelle, from inside itself. So the calcium from outside the cell isn't sufficient to cause muscle contractions by regulating troponin. Instead, it triggers the calcium from inside the cell to be released. So this process of extracellular calcium triggering intracellular calcium release is called calcium-induced calcium released from SER, sarcoplasmic reticulum. When cardiac myocytes die because of a heart attack, what components can be found in the blood? The troponin can be found in the blood and used to estimate the degree of the heart attack or the myocardial infarction. What are the three different ways that calcium can enter smooth muscles? So the first way is through voltage-gated calcium channels. The second way is through ligand-gated calcium channels. Still calcium channels, just different things that operate them. One is operated by voltage, which is action potential and depolarization. The other is operated by hormones or neurotransmitters, particles that bind as ligands and open the calcium channel. The final way is the GPCR, G-protein pathway through G-alpha-Q, because G-alpha-Q eventually turns on IP3, and IP3, you know, down the stream causes calcium release from sarcoplasmic reticulum. So, and even the first two, the ones that let calcium in, voltage-gated calcium channels that let calcium in and ligand-gating calcium channels that let extracellular calcium in, they also are activating calcium in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. It's just that one is called calcium-induced calcium release, whereas I suppose this would be the G-protein one would be a IP3. Related calcium release. So Just like calcium is allowed into smooth muscle through either voltage-gated calcium channels or ligand-gated calcium channels or, you know, the G-protein pathway with IP3. Similarly, how would, so that's to excite and create, you know, a calcium release within the cell. How would the opposite work? How would you tell the process to stop? You know, how would you inhibit it? What particle needs to get into the cell to inhibit the smooth muscle contraction, you know, to cause smooth muscle relaxation? And how does that particle get in? The particle that needs to get into the cell for relaxation, smooth muscle relaxation, is nitric oxide. Nitric oxide is small enough to diffuse into the cell, smooth muscle cell. It doesn't need anything like a channel or such, or a protein, anything like that. Just diffuses through the membrane. Now, what two regulatory particles act on nitric oxide so that, you know, it's present to act on and diffuse into cells? So without going into too much details, those two particles are acetylcholine and bradykinin. So acetylcholine and bradykinin regulate nitrous oxide, and then nitrous oxide then diffuses into smooth muscle cells. Smooth muscle cells to cause relaxation. After calcium is abundant and released into the smooth muscle cell from the SCR or SR, what happens? Where does it go? Because there's no troponin, tropomyosin in a smooth muscle cell. So what does the calcium inside a smooth muscle cell act on for the myosin-actin contraction? The calcium calmodulin complex acts on the myosin light chain kinase. So the job of the myosin light chain kinase is to enable myosin to work with actin to cause contraction. So calcium works on myosin light chain kinase, or calcium calmodulin complex works on myosin light chain kinase to cause contraction. How is relaxation achieved in smooth muscle cell? What's the enzyme that's implicated? The enzyme that causes relaxation is myosin light chain phosphatase. Phosphatase, so you ate the phosphate, so you used it up, you removed it. That's an easy way to remember phosphatases. You know, if it's a bidirectional phosphatase, that's a bit troublesome, that naming. But generally, phosphatases were named because they were moving in one direction and they were removing phosphate. So in this case, myosin light chain phosphatase is unidirectional, to the best of my knowledge, and it just eats the phosphate, which means it removes it from myosin. So that helps relax. As for the mechanism of getting to the myosin light chain phosphatase enzyme, or enabling the myosin light chain phosphatase enzyme, it's the nitrous oxide or nitric oxide diffusion. I forget which one. NO diffusion. And the NO diffusion, it has something to do with GTP, cGMP that eventually enables or enhances the myosin light chain phosphatase. But maybe that's too much information. Just NO, you know, helps myosin light chain phosphatase kick in and helps the smooth muscle relax. When speaking of muscles, what does preload signify? Preload is talking about the length of the muscle before the contraction started. So the relaxed muscle by itself was, let's say, 2 meters long. That's preload. What is the afterload when speaking about muscles? The afterload is talking about the weight or the resistance that the muscle feels as it contracts. So unlike preload, which is the measuring the length in meters, afterload is actually measuring resistance, which is the weight in either kilograms or pounds. What are the two ways that a sarcomere has its length tension relationship affected? What happens
when the sarcomere is far apart, what happens as the sarcomere contracts, and what happens as the sarcomere overcontracts. When the sarcomere is in its neutral position, it has the least amount of tension. And again, when the sarcomere is overcontracted, it again has very low tension because it's not able to be effective. The best amount of tension in a sarcomere is displayed somewhere in the mid levels of its contraction level. What is an isometric contraction? An isometric contraction is when the same length of fiber is kept despite the contraction. This will happen when the force generated by the muscle is equal to the resistance, because force and resistance being the weight, are equal. The muscle doesn't change its length anymore, so it is in isometric, iso meaning same, metric being the unit, so it's in the same length, isometric contraction. What is the force-velocity relationship in muscles? The force-velocity relationship in muscles assumes an isotonic contraction, meaning that you're applying a constant amount of force. Now, with this isotonic, same tone, same strength, with this isotonic contraction, as we continue to add more weight or add more resistance, naturally, we cannot continue to lift the weight with the same velocity. The velocity decreases. So in a constant contraction, constant force contraction, in an isotonic contraction, as the weight, resistance, or afterload increases, the velocity decreases, and that's the force-velocity relationship. What is a concentric contraction and an eccentric contraction? So again, what is a concentric contraction versus an eccentric contraction? Okay, so when we're lifting a weight, if we have more force in our arms than the weight we're lifting, then we succeed in flexing, right? That's a concentric contraction. We're successful. We lift it up. Now, as we're lifting it up, the muscle shortens. The opposite is if we're lifting a weight and it's too heavy for us and we're slowly actually losing, right? The weight is going down instead of coming up. That's an eccentric contraction. The muscle fiber is slowly lengthening because the weight is too much for us. So concentric, the fiber shortens and we successfully lift the weight. Eccentric, the fiber lengthens and we slowly admit defeat. Which type of contraction, concentric or eccentric, is especially damaging to muscles? The eccentric contraction, where the fiber slowly lengthens because it cannot generate enough force to lift the weight, at that point, we see damage in Z discs, and this sarcomere damage is called Z disc streaming. A motor unit is made up of which two components? A motor unit is made up of a neuron and the muscle fibers, which receive stimulation from that neuron and therefore contract. What type of receptors are used by all voluntary somatic muscles? All voluntary somatic muscles have nicotinic receptors, also known as nicotinic ACH or acetylcholine receptors. What is the innervation ratio when talking about a motor unit? The innervation ratio means that while one muscle fiber or one muscle cell or one myocyte is only innervated by a single neuron, that single neuron at the same time could also be innervating many other muscle cells. So it's innervating this myocyte, but it's also innervating 1,000 other myocytes. And depending on what that mapping is, one neuron to 10 muscle cells or one neuron to 10,000 muscle cells, that's what's identified as the innervation ratio. When muscle and bone come together to function as a lever, what do we call the end of the bone that's carrying all the weight? Load, we call it the load. What do we call the pivot point? Fulcrum. The pivot point is known as the fulcrum. And what do we call the muscle attachment that's helping us provide for the movement? That's just identified as force. So we have load, fulcrum, and force, and they make up the lever. Creatine can be charged and kept in muscle cells as an energy resource, and in its charged form, it is known as phosphocreatine. Now, both creatine and phosphocreatine irreversibly convert to which molecule that is excreted from our body? Creatinine. So both creatine and phosphocreatine are converted to creatinine, which is excreted from our body. What are the three types of muscle fibers, or four types of muscle fibers? Type 1, type 2A, type 2B, and the mammalian version of large mammals for type 2B is type 2X, which is what humans have. Which muscle fiber, type 1, type 2A, type 2B, or type 2X, which muscle fiber is slow and oxidative and is red in color and uses fat as its primary energy source? Type 1. Which muscle fiber, type 2X, type 2B, type 2A, or type 1, which muscle fiber is very fast and it is purely glycolytic? It is going to stain white and it's very strong in terms of the power it provides. Type 2X or type 2B, those are the fibers that are very fast, very large, glycolytic, and white. Which type of muscle fiber is a both fast twitch oxidative and glycolytic? It is medium in its cross-sectional area. It stains pink. Type 2A is a fast oxidative and glycolytic fiber. You can remember it as FOG, fast oxidative glycolytic, and it's medium sized and pink in appearance. Where are all the muscle fiber names derived from? What is it, which quality of the muscle is uniquely identified by type 1, type 2A, type 2X, or type 2B fibers? The fiber types are classified and named after the myosin heavy chain. So there are many isoforms, or there are many versions of the myosin heavy chain, and that's what the names are based off on. What are the two ways that muscle summation or successive contractions can take place? Multiple fiber summation, where we have multiple motor units involved, or frequency summation, where simply the frequency of contraction is increased. Which sensory structure in the muscles protects us from overstretching? The muscle spindle. Which sensory structure in the muscles protects us from overcontraction? The Golgi tendon organ. Is the Golgi tendon organ connected to intrafusal muscle fibers or extrafusal muscle fibers? The Golgi tendon organ is connected to the extrafusal muscle fibers. Which type of muscle fibers does the muscle spindle connect to? Does the muscle spindle connect to intrafusal muscle fibers, or does the muscle spindle connect to extrafusal muscle fibers? The muscle spindle connects to or surrounds the intrafusal muscle fibers. What are the three types of fatigues that your body can experience? The three types of fatigue are central fatigue, where your central nervous system is involved, or peripheral fatigue, where the local myocyte or muscle cell is involved, or even systematic fatigue, where lactic acidosis across the blood causes major complications across many systems. What is the difference between hypertrophy and hyperplasia? In hypertrophy, the existing muscle cells increase in volume or size. It's still 10 muscle cells, they're just bigger and better. In hyperplasia, you actually turn 10 muscle cells into 20 muscle cells. So you have more number of cells. That's hyperplasia.